This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'd like to now segue to our next speaker, Mr. Aaron Carruthers, who is the Executive Director of the California State Council on Developmental Disabilities, an independent state agency to make sure that people with developmental disabilities and their families receive the services and supports that they need. He has worked in civil rights policy and programs for over 25 years, including as an appointee of two governors for California's Attorney General and in the state Senate and Assembly. He is currently carrying out the council's goals, and last year's SCDD's work impacted more than 9 million Californians. He is a child of parents with developmental and other disabilities, is a person with disabilities, and is the parent of a young man with disabilities. Please welcome Mr. Carruthers, who will be talking about recovering from the pandemic moving forward.
Thank you so much, Dr. Takayama, and thank you so much, Dr. Kripke, for having me here today. It's wonderful to be here, and thank you for that nice introduction. There were a few details that I was going to include in saying hello to everybody, and you got the really good ones, especially the ones around the family. Thank you so much. Hello, everybody. Good morning. Thank you for being here. I'll take a moment to share my PowerPoint. So hopefully you can see the main slide, and it's a title slide that just orients us to where we are in today's conference, but also for this panel. We're in session one about being the change we need. And my topic that I've been asked to speak on is recovering from the pandemic, moving forward. Those are huge topics. And thank you, Drs. Kripke and Takayama, for the opportunity to really go in a couple of different directions. I hope in my presentation, I will bring together all three of these elements within the next half an hour. Starting off with the disclosures, I have nothing to disclose. So moving on. Just a little bit of an overview about the State Council on Developmental Disabilities. As Dr. Takayama said, we are an independent state entity created in federal and state statute to build capacity of individuals to advocate and make changes in the system. Those are our three words in federal law and state law: build capacity, advocate, change systems. But these are a little wonky. What does it mean? It means we've been here for 55 years and we find systems, we disrupt them, we evolve them, we elevate them, and we look to make systems more effective and efficient and agile and adaptive for the people who are served by those systems and their families. And we have 12 offices throughout California. I'm here in Sacramento joining you from our headquarters office. And you may, the office closest to you is in Oakland, and you may know our manager there, Sheridan Nicolau, who is fantastic. So if you know Sheridan, you know me, now you're putting the two pieces together. But what does it mean in doing our work about disrupting, and how does that relate to today's topic? Well, the pandemic itself really was a disruptor. And we know there's a lot of bad about how it's been disrupting. The pandemic disrupted our lives really in so many ways, and it did it in a way that is a motto I've seen recently: move fast, break things. Now, this motto I saw actually in relation to a Silicon Valley executive who is experienced in taking over other companies, who was describing what is the MO for Silicon Valley when they are taking over a company: move fast, break things. They were describing it specifically as it relates to DOGE and what people within the federal government should expect as DOGE is going from department and department, agency to agency: move fast, break things. But this motto really also backs up and relates to natural disasters like a pandemic that moved fast and it broke things. And many act as if COVID has left us. But really, we're living in the branch of history it created, and the imprint, the contours, the impact of that living history that we're in are really only now beginning to take shape. Recent poll from February of 2025 at the Pew Research Institute, 72% of respondents said, yes, the pandemic drove the country apart. There's lower trust in people, in each other, in institutions, whether those are government institutions or public health, health itself. We're also seeing this resurgence of self-interest, of individualism. Some have described it as a social Darwinism. There are things that happen with the pandemic as a disruptor that's been bad. We know this, we're living it. We probably could spend the next half an hour just discussing and dissecting it, but that's not the point of today's conversation. What we're here to look at is, it wasn't all bad. Surprisingly, it wasn't all bad. And maybe by the end of this, you'll believe me. When there is a disaster, when there is a disasters end up being disruptors, and things that we already know are not working become very obvious because they break down first. There are things before the disruptor, before the disaster, that we feel, we know it's not working, we experience is not working, but the pandemic as a disruptor really exposed it. It laid bare. And once it's laid bare, we can either accept it and continue on in its current state. We can attempt to fix it, or we can end it. In that, when we do this, we really need to be the change that we need, which is the focus of this session. When we're in these moments of having laid bare what is not working, these are really the moments where there's a trust building or trust losing. This exercise of trust happens in these moments. And when we see them laid bare, we really ask, do we find opportunities to fix the systems and supports and work together for solutions? Or do we keep devolving into separateness and mistrust and broken systems? So as we think about systems for people with developmental disabilities and their families, within California, the pandemic actually allowed us to take that view, take that opportunity to see it's laid bare, some things aren't working, can we work together to fix them? I'll make a plea. I'll tell you my bias up front. When we look at being the change we need, I want to put two words in front of you, illness versus wellness. And we're in a public health space, you're public health professionals, you focus on this in many ways all the time. We're always in a state of what is our own individual illness or wellness. We look at our society. What is society's state generally of illness or wellness, our community's state of illness or wellness? We also look at systems that serve people. That's the approach the state council takes. Is this system in a state of illness or wellness? I want to point out to you that there is one difference between these two words. And that is the I in illness and the we in wellness. That's the difference. We know it human, biologically, systemically, organizationally, as communities. When we go it alone, we go in a path that leads to illness. When we go it together, it's a path of wellness. And the good news is, within California, within the developmental disability system, there are many examples that we are coming together for solutions. And in fact, today's panels that are coming up focus on some of them. Let me highlight some of them for you. Just in the past year, just since the pandemic, there are significant, past 5 years, there are significant changes that are happening within the California system for people with developmental disabilities that really is taking up the opportunity of the pandemic and of COVID as a disruptor to evolve and adapt and elevate services. Three examples on this slide that you'll have panels about later today, so you can get further into detail, more in depth. One is the master plan on developmental services. This was asked for by the governor. It's being led out by the California's Health and Human Services Agency. And the words from the governor are from agency. They're looking for bold ideas to tackle the system's most ingrained in complicated problems. Actually, ingrained, complicated, those are my words. Here's the governor's words. Looking at the system's accessibility, can people who are entitled to the system actually access it? So different from version of accessibility than we typically think about in disabilities field. It really is just a matter of it's here, it's entitled, can I get it? Can I find it? And once I find it, can I get the services I need? There's also a focus on quality, so that the quality is being measured, is high. We want evidence that the money and the services that we're putting into the system result in good outcomes for individuals and people. This is an interesting task. As you all know from a public health perspective, the Lantermann Act is built on individual needs and individual responses, but typically outcomes and quality are measured in group. So there really are tasks underway to look at how do we adapt, making sure we stay true to the spirit of the Lantermann Act of individual needs and individual responses, but also being able to tell the story in equality in an aggregate way. The third piece the master plan is to look at is equity, equity for all consumers. So again, you'll have, I think maybe the next panel is about this master plan. So you'll get much, much more about that. Another change that's happened just in the past year, 5 years for the California Developmental Disability System is engagement with tribal families. Of course, tribal families were here before the systems existed, but now there's been a sort of awakening within the systems about the needs within tribal families and really doing targeted interventions to make sure that the system is available, system for families that live in tribal lands. You'll have a panel later today with Susan Goodpasture, who will tell more about those experiences. Another disruption within the past 5 years is looking at supported decision making. Supported decision making comes from the just revolutionary idea, if I can use a little humor, revolutionary idea that people have their own views on decisions that impact them. And there are ways to find that, communicate that, even if there aren't typical ways. We know in our system, there's a gravity. There's a pull towards conservatorship, which makes sense for some people in many cases, but it may just be a permanent solution for a temporary situation for other people. When the courts deem somebody's situation is so severe that they should have their rights removed, and given to somebody else, courts are usually pretty slow and cautious about returning those rights. Well, what if there's another tool for somebody who's in that middle space? What if there's another option? So supported decision-making is a panel that you're gonna hear about later today from Judy Mark, as they are looking at that specific rolling out within California, because the legislature granted $5 million to create a supported decision-making technical assistance program. Also changed some of the laws around conservatorship to make supported decision-making more of a possibility. So these are just some positive outcomes of the pandemic as a disruptor. That's all this has happened within the past 5 years, and that you're gonna have panels on later today. But let me talk about some that you won't have panels on, but are still very important disruptors. Using COVID as a disruptor to evolve and adapt and elevate services, we have now successfully phased out subminimum wage in California. Subminimum wage was the practice of paying people with developmental disabilities less than minimum wage, often by piecemeal in places called sheltered workshops. Their piecemeal work could end up earning maybe about $2 an hour. From the council's point of view, we sponsored the legislation. This was an exploitation of the labor, the effort, the work of people with developmental disabilities. When the pandemic happened, all the shelter workshops shut down. And we saw that disruptor as an opportunity to fight back against the argument that these can't be closed. Well, nobody's in them. Let's close them. So the legislature and governor agreed, phased out subminimum wage. January 2025 was the deadline. Nobody should be paid subminimum wage anymore. And something amazing happened. The arguments against doing it was that we're gonna have a generation of people who will go home, be on the couch, and nothing will happen because they can't be employed anywhere else. And the results were not true. Tracking what happened to people after they were no longer paid subminimum wage resulted in us finding out over 1,100 adults moved from earning $2 an hour to earning at least minimum wage. This is the largest employment effort I think we've ever seen for adults with developmental disabilities. This is an amazing outcome. This is a policy success, and it's evidence that some disruptors work and work well. There's still other people we're tracking. Many others went into day programs. Maybe about 9% of people who left subminimum wage are receiving no services. went home, they're on the couch, but the system's still engaged. They know who they are, and there's still opportunity to bring them back in to regional center supports and services. The other piece of a disruptor that happened with the last 5 years is the self-determination program. That is an alternate way for people to receive services through regional centers that puts priorities on independence and freedom and responsibility. What it largely does is it puts the person receiving services back in control of the dollars, where the dollars are spent. And as long as it's the dollars are being spent on services that are approved by CMS, someone can get them. They don't have to be vendored through the regional center. This opens up the possibility of finding services where we know they exist, which is often closest to us. This brings more employees into the service system. It starts to address cultural divides and competence. It allows individuals who are receiving services to have more flexibility and more say. And what we've seen, again, these are just pandemic numbers. June 2020, there were about 229 enrollees. December 2024, 5,964 enrollees. So I call this one the quiet revolution, but it's significant. So those are what has been happening in as we have used the pandemic as a disruptor. But I also want to talk about moving forward. Looking forward, what's on the horizon as a disruptor? What should we be paying attention to? What's on my mind right now is Medicaid funding. And will Medicaid funding be a disruptor? As I said before, the motto of move fast, break things is going through Washington, D.C. And sometimes systems need to be jolted, but sometimes not. When we have a natural disaster, we don't have a choice. Systems are jolted. We have to adapt, and we adapt pretty well. That's an argument. As I said in my first slide, we're still deciding how well we've adapted or what's changed in this history that we're living. But if humans are the disruptor, there is a benefit. There's a benefit that we can plan and we can be intentional and we can really make sense of what it is that we need to change. And we talk about something like Medicaid. It's a bit too big to just disrupt it by taking away a significant amount of dollars. And that really is the situation that's happening right now. In Washington, D.C., Congress has a plan to cut spending for the federal budget overall. The House proposed a plan to cut $1.5 to $2 trillion in spending cuts from the federal budget overall over 10 years. Almost half of this would come from Medicaid funding, $880 billion. And more cuts would come from CalFresh and food service programs. So this would mean much less money from Washington, D.C. to California for Medicaid and other programs that people with disabilities and older Californians and people need to live independently. Because this is on my mind and because this panel is recovering from COVID, but looking forward, I wanna spend some time on this one as we look forward. So just to level set, make sure everybody's starting on the same level of knowledge. So Medicaid is really just a health insurance program that's run by the federal government and states to provide health care for people with disabilities and seniors. 43% of Californians are in programs funded by Medicaid dollars. So that's a little over 17 million Californians would be severely impacted by cuts to Medicaid fundings or other programs. We have the details here of how they break out. The vast majority of people who are in Medicaid dollars are in our different Medi-Cal programs. That's 14.5 million people. CalFresh is included here. It's not funded by Medicaid, but it's another program that is identified to be cut to make the goals that Congress has set. That's another 5.5 million people. We can see separately, there's about 1.8 million people who are working and getting health insurance through Covered California. That's the Affordable Care Act. But there's also individuals who are benefiting through the Women's, Infants, and Children in-home supportive services through IHSS. Of course, 480,000 people through regional centers and 59,000 people, foster youth, all funded with Medicaid dollars. So often when we look at the numbers about how many people are in Medicaid, the numbers just focus on who's in Medi-Cal. When I go back to the numbers and start adding the different programs, but also removing people who are in multiple programs, we come with a much bigger impact. So what is Congress's plan? The idea is to change Medicaid funding is that on February 25th, just last week, the House in Congress, and just a reminder, Congress has got a House and a Senate, the House voted on a plan to extend $5.4 trillion in tax cuts. Those are currently in place, and they're set to expire. Their plan would extend them. Raise the debt ceiling, or how much the U.S. government can borrow, by $4 trillion, and cut $1.5 to $2 trillion. $1.5 trillion is the floor, $2 trillion is the goal. These numbers, again, are plans for impacts over the next 10 years, and Congress is using a mechanism called reconciliation. So let's dig into reconciliation. What is it, and why do they want to use it? Reconciliation is basically a procedural shortcut, and it can be used for three things. It can be used to raise or lower revenues. It can be used to raise or lower expenditures, and it can be used to raise or lower the debt ceiling. So that's how it can be used. And in this case, the plan that the House passed is to lower revenues by $5.4 trillion through extending the tax cuts, lower expenditures by $1.5 to $2 trillion, but also increase the debt by $4 trillion. So that is how reconciliation can be used and how it's being proposed by the House in this instance. But why use reconciliation? Well, it's quicker. There aren't hearings. There aren't briefings. There's limited debate about it. There's limited amendments about what can happen. But here's more key reason. It's just easier to pass. Again, Congress has the House and the Senate. And in the House, you always need a majority vote. Right now, a majority vote is 218 members of Congress. And the Senate typically needs 60% or 60 out of the 100 senators to pass. But the budget reconciliation process can be passed with just 51 votes or 50 votes plus the vice president. So they don't need the regular 60 votes to pass a regular budget bill. And they're using this process because they don't think they would have 60 votes in the Senate to approve or agree to this plan. Now, some things I've been hearing from members of Congress since last week's vote is what we voted on was just a procedural vote. It doesn't do anything. It just lets the discussion continue. Well, this is technically true. But here's the process for reconciliation. Step one is passing a budget resolution, and this sets the goals and the targets for the spending cuts. Step two is then the budget reconciliation that has the details on spending cuts. So what the House voted on last week was their version of the resolution. But here's the thing is that the resolution sets the targets and the reconciliation must meet those targets. So really, a vote for a resolution binds what's in the reconciliation. So when they say it's only a procedural vote, technically true, functionally not true. Functionally different. Something else I've heard. The resolution doesn't say Medicaid in it anywhere. Well, that's technically true. But the House's vote on February 25th to cut the $1.5 to $2 trillion also included some specific instructions to different committees. One of those committees is the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. And it tells that committee, you must cut $880 billion from the programs that you oversee. Now, here's a nice graphic from the New York Times about that committee and what that committee oversees. It oversees Medicaid, it oversees Medicare, and a few other programs. By the size of the blocks, we can see how much $880 billion is. Now, Congress and the president have already said, we're not going to touch Medicare. So that leaves $880 billion to come from Medicaid or from other programs. In looking at the other programs, the analysis show actually you can't, even if you try to eliminate all of it, you'd only get rid of about half of those boxes. So there's still, even if you eliminate everything they're doing, there would still be $600 billion that they'd need to find to cut. And if they said they're not cutting Medicare, then that would come from Medicaid. So when it says the resolution doesn't say Medicaid, that's technically true, but it gave directions with specific limits that if approved, this committee would have to meet, and this committee doesn't have many choices. Well, the committee, if this all passes, the committee may do certain things. They may call it something else. We may call it work requirements, or we're not cutting anything. We're just putting in work requirements, or we're still funding Medicaid. We're just going to do per capita caps. Or, hey, you know what? We're going to change how we're doing it, and we're going to fund Medicaid. We're going to fund programs. We're just going to give block grants. In doing any of these, each one of these actually has a price tag associated with it. So a cut by any other name is still a cut. So whatever the approach is, if this is approved, would mean states would get much less money to pay for Medicaid programs. Now, please note, the Senate has their own ideas. The Senate passed their version of the resolution, which has $320 billion in spending cuts, very different from the House's version of a goal of $2 trillion. $320 billion over the entire federal government versus $2 trillion over the federal government. The other thing to note, as I said, this is in progress. It's actively in play, so these ideas could change. When I talk to the community, and I've been doing a lot of talking to the community, individually over the past 2 weeks, I've talked to over 1,000 people. What I'm hearing at times is this won't happen, or they'd never do this, or more insidiously, this will happen to immigrants, not us. They're talking about immigrants. Well, the reality is this is happening, and Congress voted on it. It's in print, and the cuts are so big that it's going to happen to everybody in the programs. There's no way to carve out that it's going to happen to only them and not me. Another thing I'm hearing is that the president said this won't happen and he's going to protect Medicaid. Well, cutting $2 trillion can't be done without cutting Medicaid or Medicare. And that is the conclusion in the statement from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office that they issued yesterday. It's headlines today. So if the past is any lesson for the future, it's that in 2017, Congress looked to cut Medicaid funding before, and they used the reconciliation process. It really only took 2 months to go through all the steps, and it was defeated by one vote. So many advocates are using that lesson as instructions for what can be done this time. The margins in Congress are very close, so really looking at a one vote strategy. But how fast are we talking about? Well, as I said, the Senate approved their resolution on February 21st. That's the $320 billion in cuts. The House approved their resolution on February 25th. That's the $2 trillion in cuts. And Congress's calendar says we're going to use the first 2 weeks of March to try to come to an agreement because the House and the Senate must pass identical resolutions. We're expecting, so the House, Senate passed theirs and sent it to the House, and House passed theirs and sent it to the Senate. We don't believe the House is going to pick up the Senate's version. We believe that the Senate is going to pick up the House's version and use that as the starting point for negotiations and amendments and changes. So whatever Senate changes, they would have to bring it back to the House and they both have to agree on an identical plan. But here's the thing, whatever those technicalities are, whatever they agree to once they pass the resolution, it comes back to Congress as instructions. And that's when we start seeing the details of cuts. So there's a lot of effort to influence at this point of the process, but there's still a lot of the process to go. So what can anybody do? What can anybody here do? What can any person who's served by these services do? Well, you can tell your story. Your Medicaid story is important because representatives need to know how Medicaid helps you and your families, what it would mean if the to your life if the services you receive, the supports are stopped. Here's what's key. People's lived experience makes them an expert. They know more about these programs than the individuals who are voting on them. And because of that, voice is really important to make sure that the representatives understand the impact of decisions and cuts like this. Medicaid's a big word. Doesn't talk about all the different programs. $880 billion is a big number. Sort of gets depersonalized, but when people are there telling their stories, it brings the human face and experience and impact back to the conversation. Well, how can you tell your story? It's pretty easy. You just talk about what's happening in your life. I've got other trainings where I go into much more detail into how to tell your story and who to tell your story to. I'll put my email address so that you can contact me if you'd like to come to one of those. But telling your story is just, my name is, and I'm your constituent, and I'm tell them who you are. I'm a person with disability. Tell them what your life is like now because of Medicaid programs and how these programs make it possible. Tell them all the good stuff and tell them how these programs pay for it. And then tell them, really, cutting funding means I can't live my life as I do now. So in conclusion, I told you, we're talking about being the change we need, recovering from the pandemic and moving forward. So recovering from the pandemic, we see a lot of things that worry us and changes to society, but we have every reason to be optimistic about our ability to solve the problems together. Moving forward, there really are serious threats of disruptions that we must act on together. And in being the change we need, this is my call, my plea to all of us. It really, truly is the only thing that we know keeps working, which is working together for solutions and telling our stories. Thank you so much. That's my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Carruthers, thank you so very much for a very comprehensive description of what is going on at the federal level. So I'm just thinking, wow, real issues in real time sort of being involved in the making changes intentionally. There are a number of questions, but I wanted to first start off with a general question, which is, you know, the organization, the California State Council on Development Disabilities, has a sort of a relationship with both the federal government and the state government. And I'm wondering, how do you use that relationship to help make change or practice disruption at both levels? Because my understanding is that, you know, Medicaid is an example. It's not one program, it's 50 programs. So it can be very complicated at the actual state level.
Dr. Takayama, the answer to that really is what you just experienced. You saw it in real time, which is the state council will raise issues sometimes before they're on people's radars. I've been talking about Medicaid since January. That was pretty early. January 14th, the House released a draft document that said their goal was to cut $5 trillion out of the federal funding, and $2 trillion would be for Medicaid. So when I saw that, I started talking to everybody and saying, look, we need to pay attention. And the other piece I do is to then give details to help cut through all of the noise to then understand what is the reality, what's happening. So finding the signals within the noise and presenting them to people in ways that are understandable. And then the next piece is, what can you do about it? Making sure that everybody understands they have the role, they have the power, and their voice, their experience is what's important in this. So how do we do it? You just experienced it.
Thank you. There's a lot of appreciation for the clarity of your presentation and the timeliness of it. So I just wanted to let you know that you were getting that feedback. Getting back to COVID and the Department of Developmental Service and the regional center agencies were very concerned about making sure that after the pandemic, we still had a service system and that we took care of the service providers that do the important work for our community. One thing that we learned in COVID was that many families of color prefer to hire family members or have in-home services rather than center-based or agency-based, and the large service providers were taken care of and continued to get paid, even with, in my opinion, very little expectation. They didn't even make phone calls to many of their clients during the pandemic. And now we have workforce issues, we have in terms of hiring, and now we have now we have trying to get people who got used to a COVID level of service ramping up to a different level of service. And that has been difficult. And I appreciate your voice as a family member, a client, a person with a disability, because a lot of our regional center agencies and the Department of Developmental Services leadership is coming from the service provider. And, you know, we should all be together, but I'm wondering what you think about the balance.
Dr. Kripke, there was a lot in your statement just now. Would you maybe just restate the question that you'd like me to address?
How do we get back to, there is a lot there, isn't there? How do we get back to a quality of care and a client-centered focus after the pandemic?
I'm optimistic about a few things. One of them, I probably should have included in the slides. I talked about it, but I didn't label it, but it is a program called the PAVE Project, P-A-V-E, if others have heard about it. And this effort that has been funded by the legislature is to find a way to systemically measure outcomes that are really individually based. I appreciate this restatement and this emphasis on realizing the Lanterman Act, the entitlement, the individualization approach is what's important. And when I see efforts and investments that reinforce that perspective and that view, that gives me more hope about, as you said, bringing it back into balance about the Lanterman Act's origins and purposes. The master plan said very clearly, you know, the Lanterman entitlement is not on the table. That's not what we're talking about here. And the master plan itself is an effort to, again, how do we make sure the system is serving people? That's the perspective the State Council always comes from. What's your experience as a person being served or a family member? And how do we improve that? I still have ideas of how it could be done better. You know, can we take experts on human design and bring them into the systems and say, what is an individual's experience here and how do we simplify it? How do we clarify it? How do we improve it? Because we're all experiencing too much of the administrative burden or bureaucracy or time tax or paperwork. That really systemically is the next one of the big systemic frontiers.
Thank you so much. And so sort of a follow-up question, which is, once again, the function of the State Council on Developmental Disabilities. I noticed that on the website, you ask for people who are interested in joining to join. And I'm wondering, how does that happen? And especially, how do we tell our stories in ways that resonate? And I know legislative advocacy is one way to do this, but how do we do it in a concerted fashion so that we're not sort of making legislators confused, but that there's a sort of a more clear direction on what we're advocating for them to do?
Yeah, and there's a lot we could be advocating on. Even if we look federally, if we look statewide, there's a lot that we can be advocating on. So one of the pieces is just picking the priorities, and that's something that the State Council does. It picks the priorities about, okay, out of the many, many, many things that impact the lifespan, people's entire lifespan, here's what we need to focus on. And often that happens with an advocacy. If I'm following a movement, I need to look to the leaders in the movement to help me, again, distill the information, give me tools to act, and then figure out what I need to act with. I think in California, we're all kind of in a standstill or a hold steady. We're just waiting to see what happens out of the federal government and with the federal budget, because that's going to tell people, you know, what it's going to tell California how much money there is for services. If funding for all Medicaid services are cut by, those dollars are about a 15% out of the system, but the prior amount was a 30%. So if there's a 15 to 30% cut in funding, we all then need to move into how do we adapt. Unfortunately, it often becomes a food fight. That's not where we are, that's not what we want, which is why from the State Council's perspective, we're focusing early concentrated effort on trying to keep this from happening. Dr. Takayama, I put into the chat two links. They are how people can apply to be on the State Council. There is appointees at the head for the statewide State Council, which is appointed by the governor. We also have regional advisory committees in 12 different places throughout the state. So you can also be involved locally.
Thank you so much. And thank you for this presentation. And thank you for the clarity and for giving us a way to get involved. These we as clients of regional centers often think of these agencies as being some big organization that controls the things that we need, but we actually are deeply involved in running those agencies and informing those agencies. And even by law, we have to be at least half the board of regional center agencies. So these are our agencies as the people to shape as we need. So thank you so much for reminding us of that and giving us a way to get involved.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.